This is the morning brief from the Economic Times.
2021 was a strange year for money and for those earning it. Things like total cash in the country, cash reserves with companies, foreign direct investment, private equity funds in startups, the stock markets, all touched new records during the year. Banks had so much money to lend that it became the cheapest to borrow in a decade. Companies cut their debt costs, improved profitability and their performance in the markets. Blockbuster IPOs happened. The rich added to their wealth and bought new homes. Great, right, Nehal?
Sure, but on the flip side, inflation went up, many people lost their jobs, and unemployment levels are some of the highest we have seen. Inequality has widened. Smaller companies that couldn't play the market have suffered. Also, India's trade deficit grew. And if all this wasn't enough, fears over the new Omicron variant in the last month has spooked foreign investors who pulled money out of Indian markets. This has resulted in rupee becoming the worst performing Asian currency this year.
Over 1 lakh crore has been raised via IPOs this year so far, which has been a massive threefold increase over 2020. Overall, in 2021, 28 IPOs were subscribed over 10 times, 5 IPOs were subscribed over 3 times, and about 9 IPOs were subscribed between 1 and 3 times.
80 unicorns in all, and more than half of them created this year alone. That's $1 billion startups added to the list pretty much every week.
Amid the rising fear of the Omicron variant of COVID across the globe, India's central bank kept the key lending rates unchanged for the 9th consecutive time. To support the economy amid the COVID crisis, the RBI kept a hold on hiking key borrowing and lending rates.
As the Sensex crossed 60,000, the last 10,000 points have been at a remarkable speed, because not only is it the fastest 10,000 points, taking just 8 months to actually happen.
Okay, what's happening here? We had an economic recession last year due to the first and second waves of COVID-19. There could be a third wave. In fact, we are already seeing signs of it. And that may bring another financial crisis.
Yep, that's the fear, Anirban. But the thing is, financial crises aren't new. In fact, we've seen so many of them that we can almost see a pattern in how central banks and governments across the world tackle them. But a lot is different this time, and old tricks may not really work.
In this episode, the third in our special year-ender series, we try and analyze how money behaved in 2021. Whom did it go to, and whom it eluded? How are central banks across the world and in India tackling money problems, and is that enough?
We will also look at the changing patterns of saving and spending money, and what the government, the central bank, companies, and investors may do with money in 2022.
We will talk to Sugato Ghosh, ET's associate editor, and the last word on all things economics at the Morning Brief. We will also talk to Mahindra Group's chief economist, Satchidanand Shukla. There's some really engaging insights ahead. Be with us. It's Tuesday, the 28th of December. I'm Anirban Chaudhary.
And I am Nehal Chalyawala. And you are listening to Money Rush on The Morning Brief.
A familiar plot is playing out, though the origin of the problem is very different. We saw it in 2008-09 during the financial meltdown. And again, we have seen it unfold in the past 2 years. Printing money, making cheap money available, has been the ploy to tide over a crisis. So today, the world finds itself in a situation when hit by a big crisis, all it can do is create this sea of money and keep interest rates as low as possible as long as it can. And then wait for businesses to start investing, people to start spending. Now, it's a common theme that runs across nations. Though there is a difference, over and above creating money out of thin air, the rich nations whose governments can afford, they spend directly to put money in the pockets of citizens to encourage them to spend, buy whatever they want, but at least spend. That helps to support the overall demand and somehow keep the wheels moving, though at a slower pace.
That was Sugato. Let's see what happened in the past. So during the Great Recession of 2007, 8, and 9, the US Federal Reserve, among many other steps, brought to zero the interest rate charged by banks to lend to each other. The intention was to bring down the cost of borrowing to encourage companies to borrow more and invest in much needed growth. What else, Nehal?
It also introduced something called quantitative easing, which is a fancy name for printing more money and using it to buy treasuries and securities from banks. This injects more money into the system. The Fed continues to do so, and from then till now, it has injected over $8 trillion into banks this way.
Right. And as Sugata said, there were direct cash transfers to the public. In 2009, as part of the $787 billion Dreamliner-sized relief package, billions of dollars were also given as cash handouts. More recently, as part of US President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief package, $225 billion in direct payments was made to American families.
But developing countries or less developed countries don't have that luxury. They can't afford to spend their way out of a crisis in a big way. They simply don't have the money and the stomach to absorb a large deficit. And then at the end of the day, where does all that money that is created go? First to banks, with whom the central banks transact to create money. Now banks can lend money, and if there are no takers for loans, as we are seeing it now, they can invest in securities, government bonds, corporate bonds, and that pushes down interest rates because bond prices go up and interest rates come down.
In India, the RBI has injected trillions of rupees into the system to bring growth. This it does mainly in two ways, buying bonds from the market through auctions and by buying dollars from banks with rupees. The currency or money in circulation in the country rose to record highs in October as a percentage of our gross domestic product. By the way, this is after 5 years of demonetization when 80% of cash in the system was sucked out. As per the latest RBI figures, the total currency in circulation as on December 3rd was close to 29 trillion rupees, higher than the same month last year, although the rate of growth has slowed. Because, well, people who were saving during the lockdown periods of last year have started spending now. But it's still very high. Globally too, crazy amounts of money are being injected into economies. No, Nehal?
Yep. In fact, Sachidanand tells us that the magnitude of money injected in the system globally is way higher this time.
What has happened over the last couple of years is very, very unusual. This is a shock to the global economy and to the world at large in terms of proportions that we have not really seen or magnitude that we haven't seen. And what happened, therefore, is the total stock of global monetary support was around $12.8 trillion from central banks. And I'm counting only the G4 economies, right? The biggest four economies since the start of pandemic. And what this has done is this has overpowered the global interest rate cycle. And mind you, governments through their fiscal arms have also pumped in liquidity. So basically, what I'm talking about is close to $19 trillion being pumped in a very, very short span of time.
In India, interest rates are the lowest in a decade. And that's good for companies, at least the larger ones.
A lower rate helps companies, particularly larger companies, to replace older, more expensive loans with cheaper loans. It helps their bottom line. Now, these larger companies are comparatively better placed to consolidate their position, eat into market shares of weaker companies who may be less equipped in dealing with a crisis. Soon, the stock prices of top 100 or 200 companies start moving up.
According to a recent report from Bain & Company, corporate cash and cash balances are at an all-time high of $748 billion in 2021. According to the same report, private equity activity in India doubled in the first half of this year compared to last, while venture capital investments grew threefold.
If I were to talk about just the calendar 21, private equity and venture capital investments are likely to scale a record high of $70 billion. Now, that's a humongous amount. And the point is, it is flowing into a lot of these consumer-focused segments, right? B2B, B2C spaces, IT, ITES, EduTech, FinTech, AgriTech segments. This is going to help India and Indian entrepreneurs. That is only one part. The other is the primary markets. 63 companies have raised about 1.2 lakh crore through IPOs in 2021. This is a record in Indian stock market history. This is nearly 4.5 times the money raised in 2020. And if I were to look at the previous best, which was about 68,000 crore raised in 2017, I think it is nearly double.
A newspaper report in September said the Sensex touched record highs 39 times in 2021, the highest in the world. In FY21, India received a record FDI investment of $81.72 billion, with the biggest chunks coming from the US, Singapore, and Mauritius. Of course, record FDI is a 7-year trend, as in we've been breaking FDI records every year since 2013. But this year, Indian startups made their own record by attracting $36 billion of investment, more than 3 times last year.
At the end of the day, what is a private equity fund? These are large pools of money from the world's rich and the ultra-rich. Now, these are people who have made a killing in the stock market or in commodities or in properties. Now, they are looking for new avenues to put their money, some smarter bets. And they're looking for the next promising stories that would be fueled by new ideas and innovations. So what do? They entrust managers of private equity and venture capital funds with the job to scout the world to spot these stories. Now, probably India received more than it would have otherwise had received had China not gone after Jack Ma or clamped down on some of the fintech companies and startups. But there is a clear trend where alternative investment funds, or PEs and VCs as they are called, are emerging as significant sources of funds. So that is a great spin-off that is happening. So all this money which is being created, somehow it has to find a way, and it is finding its way through different avenues.
Some of that money has percolated down to needy entrepreneurs and the common man, Sachidanand tells us.
There has been this trend of people shifting to mutual funds. I mean, mutual fund accounts have, I think, more than doubled to about 181 lakh accounts in F22 as compared to just about 81 lakhs in F20. But let's look at the larger picture. While 1 lakh crore SIP flows have come in, number of DMAT accounts have gone up from 3.5 crores to 7.5 crores in just about 2 odd years. But the point I'm making is a lot of this money is also going to needy entrepreneurs, segments that need it, segments that don't exist today but can become very big.
But a large number of companies and individuals have not gained at all. I asked Sugato, what about the businesses that cannot ride this market wave? Have they lost out?
Yes, they have. If you're not in a position to raise equity to cut your debts, or if you're not credit worthy enough before the rating agencies or to the lenders where you can raise fresh loans and repay your earlier loans, you don't stand to gain, particularly at a point when demand is slowly falling. So these 2 years have been a rough time for these companies.
The job markets haven't improved much. Unemployment rate in November was about 7%. That's lower compared to the highs of 11.8% in May, but 7% is still pretty high. And according to the Center of Monitoring Indian Economy, employment in urban areas is falling. It's falling at a faster rate than in rural areas. Also, salaried jobs are going down. So I asked our guests, I see the common man is still struggling to pay the bills, to keep food on the table. So what's happening out there?
So whenever you create money, you lower interest rate, the rich gain more than the poor. That's simple, because people who are in a position to borrow, who can refinance their older loans, who can buy large homes, they gain, right? Who can borrow and invest, they gain. But the people who are the lower middle class, the informal sector, in the countries where the government is not in a position to give direct support. People whose savings are not in the stock market, who have very little exposure to the stock market, have lost out, who are dependent on fixed income like fixed deposits or company deposits. For the last 2 years, 2.5 years, it's almost a real negative return. So if interest rates fall, there would be a last section of the population. Now, that number would differ from country to country. So that section of population in India, it's particularly large. So they would lose out. And they wait for the trickle-down effect to happen. Now, that takes time. And it will have its reaction. And it is happening. You can see inflation. There is a widely shared perception that inequality has grown.
Sachidanand again gave us some stark numbers on this inequality.
The super rich in India have added about 5 trillion rupees, meaning 5 lakh crore, to their wealth over the last fiscal year alone. If I talk about 2 years, they have added about 7.5 trillion rupees in 2 years to their net worth. And how am I arriving at this number? Essentially, there are about 20.7 trillion rupees which is being managed under, say, portfolio schemes. And mutual fund AUMs manage about 10 trillion, another 10 trillion. And the segment that I'm talking about, which is people who hold these mutual fund folios or have invested in these PMS schemes, is about just about 2.5 lakh odd people. Number of PMS accounts is about 1.27 lakh. And number of retail HNI folios is 88 lakhs. So essentially, two odd lakh or 2.5 odd lakh people have made gains of about 7.5 lakh crores over the last 2 years.
In a nutshell, this is just another stark example of an unnaturally large chunk of the wealth that we've been talking about going to a minuscule percentage of the country's population.
So there is a clear Pareto play in India. The big are getting bigger, the strong are getting stronger, and the weaker ones are getting impacted or getting hit by this adversity. And this is evidence which we have globally as well, not just in India.
Also, what's really happening to the wealth of these companies that have gained? Is it being plowed back into higher capital expenditure? After all, that's what brings growth.
Not really. As per a report earlier this year from brokerage Nirmal Bang, private sector capex declined from 12.1 trillion rupees in FY19 to just about 8.4 trillion rupees in FY20. Sure, some improvement has been made in this year, and some big announcements have also come, but these primarily come from metals and commodity firms, or from big firms like Reliance, Adani, or Vedanta. Sugato agrees.
It's entirely true that there is no capex happening. Even the creditworthy companies to whom banks are willing to lend are not borrowing. Now, there are two reasons. One is a direct reason, which the economists will point out to you, is that there is not enough capex appetite in infrastructure for private companies. Now, one of the reasons is that while the central government has somehow pulled through some of the capex expenditures, it's close to its target. The states are not spending. And normally, the way the capex cycle moves is that the government spends, then the private sector starts spending. That cycle then starts moving. But here, I would say there is another aspect, and we saw that in 2008-09 also, is that suddenly the world looks very, very uncertain. Because today, if you have to put in a 5,000 crore or a 10,000 crore or 20,000 crore plant or extend your existing factory lines, you don't have the demand visibility. You don't know how the demand patterns, the consumption patterns, the export markets, even the domestic market would grow or shape up in the next few years. Suddenly, the big companies, they feel rattled. They are unsure where to put the money, where to stick your neck out. It happened in 2008-09. It's again happening now. So it is just not because the central or the state capex is lagging, particularly states. I would say that even the private sector themselves, they are unsure where to put the money. And the entire equation has changed because most of the money is being attracted by the equity money, at least is being attracted by the startups. And these are people who are driving up valuation by disregarding EBITDA. So the large old world economies, the job providers, the manufacturing world of India, I would say they're a little confused.
Okay, so here's what we have so far. A system full of cheap money, big companies getting bigger, rich getting richer. Smaller companies are languishing, poor is getting poorer. Wealth is not being used for expansion because demand and business are uncertain. Also, investments are not necessarily following the most profitable businesses. So that adds to the cluelessness. Clear thus far? Okay, now let's move on to another side effect of too much money. Inflation. India's wholesale price inflation, or WPI, rose to a record high of 14.23% in November. What's WPI? It basically tracks the prices of all the things that are processed or worked upon before they reach us consumers. So think about steel before it becomes a car, or textile before it becomes brand new clothes. Retail inflation, which tracks the prices that we pay, also rose to a three-month high.
But Nehal, this time it's not just textbook economics of more money chasing less goods, right? There are supply constraints as well. Ships are stuck in ports across the world and shipments are late. Freight rates have soared. In fact, this has led to a rise in input costs and a shortage of supply, and that has pushed up prices too.
Fair point, Anirban. And anyway, high inflation is bad, bottom line. To control it, central banks go to great lengths. They take steps to reduce consumer demand. How? By increasing the rates at which they lend other banks. So, these banks then hike the rates at which they lend to consumers. When lending gets expensive, spending goes down, demand goes down, prices drop, voila, inflation has slowed down.
But in India, the RBI has not touched interest rates yet. Borrowing rates in India are the lowest in 10 years. The RBI is trying other steps to pull excess cash out of the system, like variable reverse repo rate auctions, through which banks basically lend excess liquidity back to RBI. Meanwhile, the US Fed has spoken about 3 rate hikes in 2022. Globally, there have been 114 instances of rate hikes in 2021. 89 of them came in the second half itself. This compares to 207 rate cuts in 2020.
Well, there have been contradictory signals in the global market from central banks. So it's the economy today is concentrating on how India can navigate between a US and a Europe where rates are rising, or at least the central banks are hawkish. But you have a rate cut from China, which is indicating some loosening in Asia. Where does India figure in all this?
The central bank's skill lies in determining the pace at which this unwinding takes place. Now, unless there is a crippling third wave and that leads to another round of lockdowns, interest rates hikes are unavoidable. But rate hikes can't be too sharp. It has to be gradual. Not just because economies are nursing the wounds of pandemic and more loans could turn bad and there are no takers for big loans. I also feel there is a fundamental change that has happened over the past few decades. Central banks' ability to raise interest rates sharply to kill inflation has come down. Central banks have to walk that knife edge. It's a razor's edge, right? They have to weigh every decision. They have to be very careful in raising interest rates, in choosing the timing of the interest rates, the way the signals they give, the stance they take, the sound bites before the press. Everything matters and everything would move the market, particularly the bond markets, which influence the interest rates. So I don't think Paul Volcker could have done today what he did in the US of 1981 as the Fed chairman. Pensions, earnings, and well-being of a large population today, even though it could be a small percentage of the total population, but that population, which has a significant say in the final consumption, their earnings, their pensions and returns are linked to the stock market. So sharp, rapid hikes will impact markets and can have a negative impact on wealth effect in terms of consumption. And so this collateral effect the collateral damage of a sharp and rapid hikes in interest rates, I don't think government sovereigns and monetary authorities can afford the way they could, say, 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
And what can the government do? Surely it's a tightrope for it too, this balance between growth and inflation, especially with elections coming up in no less than 5 states next year.
The government has made efforts in terms of cash, in terms of kind, and also providing some sort of a liquidity assistance, which is short-term in nature, to tide over the problems. This also includes MSMEs. It also includes, if you recall, some bit of EMI. I mean, the interest waiver on EMIs for housing loans was actually given back to people who availed these loans. I believe the government should continue to do these interventions, whether they are in cash or in kind, and also double down on infrastructure. If the government doubles down on infrastructure and construction, and also housing, we should be able to support some of these rural and urban jobs at the lower end. I do believe the government will continue to address this inequality of huge proportions, even through the budget.
Okay, and what about growth? India's economy grew at 8.4% in the July to September quarter. Well, the number may sound good, but of course it's on a lower base, right? Here's what Shukato thinks.
Now, growth in all likelihood would be higher even next year, 22-23. The first quarter of the next financial year would show a rebound when the numbers are compared with the first quarter of 21-22, when businesses and growth suffered due to the second wave. So in quarter one of next year, that is 22-23, you will clock in a higher rate because you are comparing first quarter of 22-23 with the first quarter of 21-22, and the growth will be higher. So in one quarter, if you have a high growth, the average will show a decent growth for the full year, that is 22-23. So I would say the real test would be 23-24, when all the base effects would wane.
Sachidanand tells me that with companies' financial growth returning, credit growth, which is stalled now, will revive.
I think now corporate balance sheets are in a fine fettle. They're doing better. If I look at bank balance sheets, they are again doing better. NPAs have come off from the highs that we have seen in the past. So if I look at gross NPAs, they dropped to a 5-year low of 7.5%. So they're in a far better shape. Although the pandemic, I mean, if the Omicron were to become a big problem, this can worsen. But the point I'm making is, from a medium-term perspective, the NPA problem seems to be getting addressed or going down. And if you look at bank credit growth, it's, I think, grown by about 7-odd% in, say, November and the last data that we have for. In terms of segments that can really grow is, I think retail is something where we are seeing some activity. Housing is a segment that is likely to do well. Going forward, as the government doubles down on investment-led growth strategy that the last budget spoke about, I do believe that corporates will also start to really borrow for working capital. And thereafter, once some confidence comes in terms of capex, we will see a full credit revival in the next, say, 18 to 24 months.
The last 2 years have really changed how we save, spend, earn, invest money. But Sachidanand says that the real change is yet to come. How we deal with money in the future will be quite unrecognizable from now.
The form or the way we interact or use money might undergo a rapid change. We are already seeing some changes, which is digitization. Existence of digital as well as physical coexistence, which a lot of people call phygital, and the mode of intermediation, right? If you compare the Indian economy to say China, or any other peer economy, the Indian financial sector is far better, bigger and deeper as compared to these, especially the equities and the this side of the market, not really debt markets. Asia as a whole lags over there. But if you look at just last 4 or 5 years, a lot of niche players payment gateways, the whole UPI thing, and now you have these bitcoins, crypto assets, etc., which are now gathering pace much faster than anybody would have thought. So you might want to fight as a policymaker or try to restrict these things, but the underlying technology is so powerful. Blockchain as a technology is so powerful that it will catalyze or it will morph into several segments or several ways which will get lapped up by the savers or investors or whichever segment you talk about.
So as the pandemic upended the global economy, central banks and governments walked a tightrope balancing growth and inflation. The result was a money rush in many economies. Those who were in a position to leverage the chaos benefited greatly, but many got the shorter end of the stick. The chaos also tested our financial systems and led many to question the established methods used by our institutions to deal with a crisis. Meanwhile, the meaning of money and wealth are constantly changing. The metamorphosis will only become more rapid and more prominent in the coming years.
That's all from us today. You were listening to Money Rush on The Morning Brief. This was the third episode in our special year-ender series that explores the biggest themes of 2021. I'm your host, Nehal Chalyawala.
And I am Anirban Chaudhary. Producers for this episode were Diya Rekhi from The Economic Times and Varun Kapahi from Awaaz. Sound editor, Sondarya Jayachandran from Awaaz. Executive producer, Arijit Barman.
The Morning Brief airs every Tuesdays, Thursdays and Fridays. If you like this episode, do share it on your social media. Send your feedback to us at themorningbrief@theratetimesgroup.com. Credits for all external clips used in this episode have been mentioned in the description.